Someplace there's got to be a place where people are free to discuss what they know and what they don't know and to find out what they can.
Radioactive Waves is presented by the National Museum of Nuclear Science and History. Together, we will explore all things atomic, nuclear, and radioactive, along with some interesting surprises from our museum's collections and connections.
Hello, welcome to the podcast. My name is Anna Part, and I'm here with my fantastic co-host, David. How are you doing, David?
I am doing wonderful, Anna. Good to see you, even if it is virtual here. Good to see you, and definitely good to hear you.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I'm excited for this month's episode. David actually brought this to my attention. I was not paying close attention to, you know, what history theme the month was. And he said, hey, what are we doing for Women's History Month? And I went, oh. After making such a big deal about Black History Month, I was completely oblivious. So thank you, David, for bringing this
sure.
up.
It's a team thing. Yeah. Sometimes we get our head down in our work and we're not, I'm sure I don't always pay attention to what month of history we're celebrating or yeah. whether it's, Graham Cracker Day or whatever. Although I think I would know yeah. if it was Graham Cracker Day.
Well, that's part of that's why I feel a bit guilty is that Women's History Month is maybe a little bit more important than Graham Cracker Day. But
I think so. Yeah.
So this episode, we're going to be talking about the prolific Chinese scientist named Qian Xiang Wu. She was born on May 31st, 1912, in Liuhui, China, which is actually April 29th on the lunar calendar. She was born into a family that was kind of politically active. Her father was an ex-military engineer. His name was Wu Zonghe. And he was a democratic writer whose works were actually eventually banned in China. Qian Xiang Wu was the middle child of three and the only girl in her family. However, her democratically minded father thought that educating girls was very important and actually established a school in their hometown specifically to educate women. And actually the school served any of the girls in quite a large radius around their hometown. So yeah, she was very educated and very encouraged to be educated by her father and by her home life. Qian Xiang Wu graduated at the top of her class in 1929 from the Suzhou Women's Boarding School number 2. That's not the school that her father established, but it was a prestigious boarding school for high school age students. So she had already gone to her father's school, which was, I would say, elementary middle school, sort of. Wu had chosen the teacher training program from this high school as it was particularly sought after and highly regarded. But when she found out that her friends in the standard course that was also taught at the same school were studying more varied subjects than her program, she actually started borrowing books from her classmates to study in her downtime so that she wasn't missing anything. So she basically did double high school and still graduated at the top of her class. Voluntarily did double high school. I don't know about you, David, but I would not.
I have a daughter like that. I understand.
Well,
yeah, that is not me. No, I voluntarily slept through high school. Yes.
It's impressive, to say the least. After she graduated, she attended the school now known, it had a different name at the time, but now it's Nanjing University. And she originally started studying math. However, in 1930, she changed her major to physics. She had just read a book about Marie Curie, and there was a lot of new research happening in this field in the first decades of the 20th century. You know, Rentgen, who we've talked about before with his X-rays, still pretty new, only a couple decades old as far as research goes. There was a lot happening in physics during this time, and so she was excited.
It was still a hot topic.
Exactly, and wanted to learn more about it. So during this time, her classmates often looked to her for leadership and asked her to speak up about political issues. Because Wu was an excellent student and because her family was kind of political, her classmates figured that she would be able to get away with a lot more than maybe some of the other students. You know, you have the top of the class, probably not going to get in trouble with the university.
If you work to earn these opportunities, mm-hmm. use the opportunities you've earned.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then she also wasn't going to get in trouble with her family. So they really looked to her to help them use their voice at this university. And she didn't really even consider herself an activist, but she felt compelled to help out her students, her peers. So in 1931, Japan invaded Manchuria, and this triggered a bunch of political activism in China. Many students across the nation were demanding that that the Chinese government declare war on Japan. And Wu organized several protests and was very strategic in her planning of these events. She would often schedule protests and demonstrations in places that would discourage violence, such as maybe like historical places, like in front of a palace or, you know, something like that. She also often would schedule events just before holidays, which I think is genius, because if everybody was really eager to get home for the holidays, you know, the next day they had to be somewhere with their family, it was way less likely that either the demonstrators or the police were going to stick around long enough for there to actually be violence. So she was really like...
Right, just make your statement and move on.
Absolutely. So yeah, she helped to make sure that these events never got out of hand. In 1934, she spent a short period of time working as a teaching assistant right after she graduated. And then she actually became a research assistant. While she was working as a research assistant at Academia Sinica in Taiwan, her mentor, Gu Jingwei, encouraged Wu to study in the U.S. just as she had. So she had a female mentor in China who told her, hey, it would be really great for you and for your career to go study in America. Go check it out. Wu moved to the U.S. to attend... actually, she originally was going to attend the University of Michigan. But while she was staying with a former classmate in San Francisco, she learned about the University of California in Berkeley in 1936. And so she actually changed her mind after getting a really lovely tour of Berkeley's campus that she really wanted to stay there. Luke Yuan, another Chinese student who was studying physics, showed her the university's cutting-edge physics facilities, and Wu was really impressed. There were also a bunch of really big names on Berkeley's physics staff at that time. I mean, 1936. Oppenheimer, whose beautiful voice is featured in our opening every day, was a member of Berkeley's staff. Yes, thanks. And I mean, there were other big names like Ernst Lawrence. He would eventually be the namesake for Berkeley's National Labs. And he was also, you know, won a Nobel Prize in 1939. So it was a big deal. And she thought, yeah, absolutely. Berkeley's a bit of me. So Wu decided to stay at Berkeley after being wooed by faculty
Wow.
and her soon-to-be
You gotta do it.
I know. I'm sorry. I joke actually, this serves a double purpose. I joked about Wu being wooed because, yeah, it sounds like your last name, but also Luke Yuan, the student that I just mentioned, would one day become Qian Xiang Wu's husband. They were married.
Okay. So she was being wooed. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So they were actually married in 1942 on May 30th, just before they both moved east for a job that Luke Yuan had secured near Princeton, New Jersey. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. But while she was at Berkeley, she built up a reputation for just being relentlessly accurate, and was known for building and adjusting equipment herself to do experiments. She had a really, you know, her reputation was that she was very skilled at designing experiments, which, I mean, I don't know if everyone knows this, but designing experiments is one of the hardest parts of science. It's really, really hard to figure out how to capture information in a way that you're not getting other information muddying the waters. So,
especially in the context when you start to get, you know, to something that's a fairly new field, because as we spoke about, you know, in the Manhattan Project and mm-hmm. things like that, they had to design the equipment, you know, that would
exactly
be able to test for whatever their theory was. And so, you know, it's not a matter of, hey, I'm going to put this into that box and shake it around and see what happens. You know, they've got to go that extra mile and say, okay, well, first, I can figure out something that is going to be able to test this. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yeah, like to say there's a lot there in just the equipment end of it that we take for granted.
Yeah. And we mentioned this a little bit in our Jasper Jeffries episode last month, that, you know,
Correct, the instrument
section was really integral to the whole operation, just because how else are you supposed to measure all this stuff? On the atomic level, like, you need really specific equipment to do really specific experiments. So having a skill in that specifically is really, really prized in the field of physics. She graduated from Berkeley with a PhD in 1940, and again, top of her class. It was said that her PhD outmatched what was expected of PhD students, and that her work was very high quality and ahead of where she was expected to be in her education and career. Unfortunately, she was not able to return to China because of the budding tensions that would eventually lead to World War II. There was a lot politically and militaristically that was happening at this time. And so she tried to stay at Berkeley. However, the United States had passed the Racist Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882, and that was still in effect. It wouldn't be replaced until 1943. And then it was replaced by the Magnuson Act, which allowed a measly, again, racist, exclusionary 105 people from China were allowed to immigrate to the U.S. a year under the Magnuson Act. So it really, this attitude, this racist attitude in government, as well as, I'm sure, among the population, but made it
definitely
nearly impossible for her to remain in the U.S. without a job. I should mention here that the Magnuson Act was in place until the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1952, so another decade, and that abolished direct racial barriers, but was still, you know, not the best. But she figured it out. She was eventually able to find work at Smith College, but the East Coast was not really for her. She wasn't happy there. She missed doing research. It was a teaching position at Smith. And she missed her husband, who had to commute Smith was a couple hour drive from Princeton, and it was kind of a rough time for her. So what she did, she reached out to Ernst Lawrence, and he wrote her several letters of recommendation. And in 1943, she became the first female physics teacher at Princeton. So,
oh, that's awesome.
It was a good idea for her to have gone to Berkeley and to make those connections, because got her a job just in the nick of time. However, I mean, even being the first female physics teacher at Princeton, it was clear that STEM had a sexism problem in the 1940s, and all of her students were male. So, breaking glass ceilings, doing great, but still in an environment that was not ideal. The next year, in 1944, Dr. Wu began working on the Manhattan Project at Columbia University. She was mostly working on fine-tuning instruments, which is why I made such a big deal earlier about, you know, her knack for experiment building. She improved Geiger counters, and she was also working on the enrichment of large quantities of uranium in order to actually, you know, make the bomb. We needed quite a lot of uranium, and so she helped figure out how to make more.
Which was a large part of that project, is, making that
absolutely
material available or usable.
So really, her work contributed to the development of the atomic bomb. And she never said exactly how she felt about this work, but she did make it clear that she was kind of two minds about the atomic bomb. She was acutely aware of Japan's treatment of the Chinese and the war crimes that they had committed, but she also believed that atomic weapons were simply too powerful, and she hoped that, you know, one day there wouldn't be any reason to have atomic weapons.
Well, I think that we see that in, you know, the writings of a lot of the, you know, even Oppenheimer, a lot of the scientists that were involved. I mean, it's a matter of this is an extreme power, and it's something that you would hope would never have to be used.
Exactly.
You know, but it's one of those things that it's also something that may be necessary. So I'm glad that I do not have to wear those shoes where I have to make those kind of decisions, or, you know, that's pretty heavy. And I think we saw that in the writings and statements by a lot of the scientists and a lot of the people that were involved was, this is a terrible power. You know, terrible in its magnitude as well as its abilities. Yeah, it's a rough thing. It would be, you know, rough to be part of it. At the same time, I think if I was of the scientific mind to say, man, look at what we can do. You know, I mean, it would be so hard to, you know, the look what science can now do and what we're working toward as far as on a scientific end, you know, not on the humanity end necessarily, but on the scientific end, you know, this is a game changer. This is a, you know, just a changer in the way that everything is viewed, you know, when you change it on that atomic level. So, it would be hard to not be of a, you know, a split mind on that.
Yeah. But, I mean, she was really, really helpful during the Manhattan Project. Between her work with Geiger counters and the uranium refining, she also helped Hanford. Hanford was one of the sites in the Manhattan Project. They did a lot of they were working on nuclear energy and using and developing reactors. So she actually went out there to help them out because they were having problems with one of their reactors. And her work as a graduate student actually helped her pinpoint that these problems were coming from xenon 135, which is a byproduct of the fission process. And it was slowing down the startup of the reactor. And so she was able to figure that out and help them out, too. So
that's awesome.
She did a lot. In 1944, in March, she became the first tenured woman on Columbia's staff. She became a senior scientist and broke another glass ceiling. She, in this job, she studied beta decay and actually disproved a couple of Fermi's ideas, which I think is always fun and exciting to, you know.
Right, to find out, hey, I'm going to challenge this. Well, I think that that's what, when we talk about that Wu experiment, she kind of kept that going.
Yeah. And then in 1945, she and her husband, Luke Yuan, decided to stay in the U.S. because they really did not want to raise their son in a communist country. And during this period, they had like very little contact with home. It was a really tumultuous time and they didn't know what would be waiting for them at home. And so they decided they would do what they could to remain in the U.S. indefinitely, even though that was not the original plan. So then 5 years later, in 1954, she became a naturalized American citizen. However, that was a particularly long and complicated process because not only could they not contact home, but their passports had technically expired and it was a mess. So that's probably why it took 5 years, is that racist government officials didn't want to let them in, and also they didn't have passports. So it was very complicated, but they did it. They became American citizens, and we are better for it. And then you mentioned the Wu experiment. A couple of years later, Dr. Wu had a couple of colleagues come to her. Dr. Li and Dr. Yang came to her and asked her for help in devising an experiment for one of their theories. This is where I get real fuzzy. I understand that she made an experiment to help her colleagues. David,
sure,
you want to help?
Yeah. Well, that's as we mentioned earlier, it's now referred to as the Wu experiment. Mm-hmm. And it was, again, one of those things where, okay, this is something that had been assumed for many, many, many years. And that is the kind of, we say law, but more of a theory of parity. Mm-hmm. And that is something that in nature, electromagnetism, our strong nuclear forces, these forces all will exhibit parity. And that is, if you were to mirror it, you would have your right as a left, vice versa. You know, when you look into a mirror, everything, you know, your right hand is now your left hand. And that is parity. It's if you were to book match the world. And when we get into kind of the theoretical end of that, or, you know, then we have, you know, our Stranger Things upside down. Because it is that because quantum is kind of, a lot of that theory is based off of that parody, you know, your bizarro world, your mirror mask, a lot of our, you know, kind of social pop culture with this other dimension is going to be a mirror of our dimension. That's based off of this parody.
Okay.
And so that's, you know, that's saying that if you were to flip something, it's going to be the exact opposite. Well, the Yang and Li had some theories on if that's actually true all the way down to what we call our weak interactions, which is a weak interaction is when it's all the way down to a level, you know, smaller than the size of a proton. There is an energy there. That weak interaction or that force there, they said, okay, well, that should also follow parity because we see everything else. If something is mirrored, it's going to be mirrored all the way down to that level. And that's what they decided to challenge because they thought, well, Is it, though?
Are we sure about that?
Yeah, are we sure about that? How do we know that? Mm-hmm. And so they actually ran what was called the Wu experiment. And that Wu experiment, what they did was they got cobalt-60, and the cobalt-60 has got an intrinsic spin, okay? And spin is one of those terms when you get down to things that small that we can't see, we try to describe them in things that we can understand.
Okay.
You know, we say that quarks have got flavors. Well, you know, you can't taste a quark, but it's exactly, yeah. And that quarks have got colors and you know, like there's quantum flavor dynamics, which is, you know, that the flavor of the quarks. And that's that spin. It's a way of describing something in a way that I can put that out and you would say, okay, well, I get it. It's the spin of something. Mm-hmm. Because we understand that. Well, what they did was they got very cold, very low temperatures. They got this cobalt 60 and they lined them up. Okay. So they put their spin. It would be kind of the quantum equivalent of like the angular momentum, which is another term that you hear. But it's they put them in line to where you have two of them that should be mirrored. Okay. They're running. Okay. The same. So this happening, they had a little device because you've got to have something very, very cold and able to do this. So they used some magnets to actually get it colder. They used cerium, magnesium, nitrate, and they got those little atoms in there and they got them to where they're spinning in what would be the same way. Mm-hmm. Now, if you've got one on the left and you've got one on the right, your parity would say they're going to emit the same. They're going to match.
Yeah.
Well, what happened is they found out that nature, like me, is left-handed. And they found that it's got a tendency to go to the left. Your left is going to have a greater emission than your right. And this was something that they were able to actually show over and over again. It wasn't just this was very reproducible.
I hear they like that in science. Were
able to reproduce this. Exactly, yeah. And this is what because the scientists at first were saying, no, there's no way. There's no way because it doesn't make sense because we've got parity. I mean, if you've got a leaf growing in nature, the odds on, you know, everything growing in pairs are going to be the same. All the way down to your magnetism, everything's parity in general. And why would it be down to this level where things are a little bit different? And that was that Wu experiment, was that violation of parity in showing that cobalt 60 did not always mirror. And so, a lot of your quantum stuff was now blown out of the water of what they thought was, it would be a perfect mirror. It kind of really was a changing point just in the theoretical. They were able to discover that on that submolecular level, things are not always the same, that nature is left-handed. And so I like saying that just because, left-handed. But yeah, so that was the Wu experiment. I think if you picture, if you take a wet rag in both hands, you got the same amount of water. Mm-hmm. You spin them, the same speed. You should have the same amount of water splashing all over your bathroom. But what happens is when you get down to that molecular level, you spin them at the same speed. You have the same amount of water, of emission there. Mm-hmm. The ejection is actually leans just a little bit to the left.
Interesting.
So that was the Wu experiment.
Well, thank you for explaining that. That's much better than anything that I read. So thank you, David. I think I get it. So this experiment that, is quite fundamental, it sounds like, as far as theory and what people are trying to learn about in physics. In 1957, Li and Yang won the Nobel Peace Prize for their work on this problem. I should mention this kind of gets used as a moment where men got credit for something that a woman did. And that's not exactly.
I was actually going to ask you to see what was going on there, because you did mention that Li and Yang won, but I didn't. Yeah. Okay.
So it's a little bit complicated because although all three of them, Wu, Li, and Yang, were all working on the same problem, this parody and proving or disproving the way that it works, they weren't doing the same experiment. Does that make sense? She helped with the experiment, but Li and Yang were the main scientists on the project and the ones who were theorizing and, you know, doing the full project.
Okay. Oh, and it's probably, again, that instrumentation part, you know, like we spoke of earlier. Is that maybe she helped facilitate their experiment more than – okay.
And that's – and it's – she also ended up writing a paper after this that was on a slightly different subject than what Li and Yang were doing. And she published that as just her, whereas – okay. They had all thought that they were kind of equals in this project. And so it gets kind of fuzzy because it just – they weren't actually working on exactly – same problem, different aspect of the same problem, sure. Mm-hmm. Right? So it gets a little muddy. I can't say for sure whether or not – you know, she got the short end of the stick. Robert Oppenheimer stated in a speech that he thought all three people should have been honored with the Nobel Prize.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because they were all working on the same question in different ways, but they weren't – it just – I don't know. It's more complicated than just, oh, these guys took credit for all her work. It
and she didn't. Yeah. Right.
Exactly.
We don't know the whole story there.
Yeah, and it's kind of complicated. Sure. Okay. So.
Yeah.
But the next year, in 1958, she actually used her knowledge of molecular science to help with sickle cell anemia. She brought the study of sickle cell anemia down to a molecular level and was able to make some great progress in that area.
Awesome.
Helped along. Yeah. The medical field to better treat patients. In 1962, she and Luke Yuan went back to China for the first time. So remember, she went off to graduate school in the 1940s, and she had not been home for 20 plus years. It was great. She was very happy to be home, but unfortunately, she had missed the death and the funerals of both her parents and her older brother. So it was kind of a somber and very sad, but also jubilant and homecoming sure. sort of trip.
Well, she was actually scheduled. The Wu experiment was a mm-hmm. holiday experiment. It was in between Christmas and New Year. And she and her husband were actually scheduled to take a vacation out there. And she stayed home for that experiment.
Yeah. So dedicated to her career and not, you know, to the detriment of her family at all, but certainly she had an unconventional, for the time, relationship with her husband where, you know, he's the one who really was the homemaker and the child care provider, and she was the one who was out doing science. So,
yeah.
But by all accounts, had a really loving and wonderful marriage, and it worked for them. So,
awesome.
There you have it. In 1966, she published a book with Stephen Manowski called Beta Decay, which is actually kind of a seminal text. It's like quite a standard book in the field nowadays.
Okay.
In 1973, she went back to China again. This was the second time she had been back. And she found out that during the Cultural Revolution in China, her parents' tombs had been desecrated. And that was kind of a very upsetting moment for her, obviously. But sure. On the other hand, This is actually an interesting moment because the Chinese government actually gave her an official apology for this desecration, which is, I mean, that's a big,
that's awesome.
A big deal. A communist government saying sorry for something that happened is, that's great.
sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Any government, so, really.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Agreed. In 1977, she became the first female president of the American Physical Society. And this is really when she began to work on some of the more social issues in STEM. You know, after her retirement, she continued this work. Wu fought for the further inclusion of women in STEM subjects. She has a really great quote that, I mean, I would take it with a pinch of salt. It's a little... It's good. Here, let me tell you. Okay.
Right.
So she's quoted as having said, "In China, there are many, many women in physics. There is a misconception in America that women scientists are all dowdy spinsters. This is the fault of men. In Chinese society, a woman is valued for what she is, and men encourage her to accomplishments. Yet she remains eternally feminine." So yeah, I think
That's actually kind of cool. Yeah.
She said what she meant and she meant what she said. And I appreciate that. So another thing that is maybe a little bit during her lifetime, she was dubbed the Chinese Marie Curie in her home country. And she's often referred to this way nowadays as well. That's actually how I first heard her referred to, was the Chinese Marie Curie. And I was like, what? Who? And this is kind of a tricky moniker, just because a lot of people think that this is a great honor. Marie Curie was an amazing scientist, and she's probably the most famous person in nuclear history. She, you know, made great strides in her field, and it's an honor to be associated with her. On the other hand, Chinese Marie Curie also kind of might be a poor comparison because Wu's work was so much more sophisticated than Curie's.
Well, anytime that they call you someone else, you know, based on your achievements.
Exactly.
That puts you in the shadow of that other person.
Exactly.
Right. And hers were, I mean, you were on a different level at that point.
Yeah.
You know, by the time that she had come along, I mean, things were at a different level. You know, she was similar to Curie, shaking the foundations of the way that it was traditionally thought. But she was shaking them her own way. I think, like I say, anytime someone, you know, if they called me the bald version of someone else, well, then that puts
me in the shadow
of that person. Yeah, Bill Nye the Science Guy. Which that's, I mean, I'm fine. I'm not that to that level.
Well, but, you know, that's just it.
Is it,
like,
is a,
it's both.
Right.
It's both a slight to her and also an honor at the same
time.
And
a compliment. It's like, yeah, it's one of those things that's tricky. Right.
Yeah. You know, it also is comparing her to a white European woman, which is kind of a, with this, like,
right,
the Chinese version
the Chinese
of the.
Version
yeah,
of,
as if.
Exactly.
Marie Curie is the standard. And so.
Right.
It's not, I can't. I think it goes both ways. I think it's both a compliment and a bit of a slight. So there you go. And this.
Hopefully she took it as 100% compliment.
I think so. She really liked Marie Curie. Like, that's documented
right.
in her life.
You would
so
think
I,
that
I
she
think
would.
That,
right.
Yeah, I don't think that she was mad about it. Yeah, and despite both the racist and sexist conditions that she endured throughout her life and throughout her career, Dr. Wu won awards for her recognition, including the first ever Wolf Prize in Physics, the Comstock Award, and the National Medal of Science, among many, many other awards. So she was recognized by her field as being top-notch, despite
right. well,
all of these hurdles.
Right, well, she was a game-changer, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And on February 16th, 1997, Dr. Qianxiang Wu died in New York City at the age of 84. And according to her request, Her remains were scattered at the school that her father had founded, which I think is so sweet.
Oh, that's awesome.
So cyclical. Yeah, that's super cool. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's...
Yeah, that's a Ghibli movie. That's awesome.
That's Qian Xiangwu. Fantastic lady.
Sure. Well, I had, prior to you saying, hey, what about doing a podcast on her? I had heard just some of the, the theories behind the experiment. I had never heard of the experiment itself. I had actually seen the picture, the black and white of her, but I didn't really know who it was or, had no reference behind it. So I really appreciate you putting together this educational for me podcast, about her, because this has really been cool. I really appreciate it.
Well, as always, I think we've both taught each other something, because I learned a lot more about nature being left-handed and about the way that, subatomic particles spin. So thank you, David. That was great.
There you go.
Well, before we sign off, as always, we have to thank our Atomic History patron members. Thank you guys so much. We would not be doing this podcast at all without you guys. We appreciate you so much. And we hope to see you at our gala later this month. Please check it out on our Facebook and Instagram. And if you have any questions or concerns or comments or anything about the podcast that you'd like to tell us, please feel free to email us at info@nuclearmuseum.org.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, Anna. And I think as we wrap everything up, and as we end pretty much everything, don't forget
to wash your hands.
Radioactive Waves has been presented by the National Museum of Nuclear Science and History. Join us next time for more interviews, histories, and insights on topics like the Manhattan Project, science and pop culture, the atomic age, and the differences between nuclear fact and fiction.